WBAI. Where do we go to get our words out? Where do we go if you've been arrested unjustly? Where do you go if someone's taken your children unfairly? Where do you go to seek justice? We must keep this station alive. Yeah. Alive. WBAI. No
justice. This is listener-sponsored, locally controlled WBAI New York.
Stay tuned for Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg coming up. WBAI New York, WBAI.org. Stay tuned.
Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Later on, how global billionaires grow their wealth into trillions, profiting from the pandemic, and then how the New York Times kicked its tech workers to the streets over their fight to unionize. But first, a special report from Brian Concannon, executive director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti. Brian Concannon, apart from emergency relief, what kinds of aid should be sent to Haiti and otherwise help us understand Haiti's vulnerability and how to think about the Haitian people building stability and prosperity through justice?
When you talk to Haitians about the response to natural disasters or any response by the international community to Haiti, they bring up issues of sustainability, of democracy, of resiliency, because they know that the fact that they have an anti-democratic government that is propped up by the United States in power is part of why the government isn't doing a better job of responding to everything from COVID to Saturday's earthquake. And they want a response that takes into account the need for democracy, the need for sustainability. That question of what the U.S. should do is first listen to the Haitian people and allow Haitian people to express their voice. And obviously, you can't, in the next week, you can't change Haiti's government. And this has been a crisis that has been almost 10 years in the making. But one of the things, as the United States responds, it needs to say, okay, how are we going to lay the groundwork for a government that will be representative and will actually be accountable to the Haitian people. The U.S. government also needs to take accountability seriously itself. As we do our own response, we need to say, are we really meeting the needs of the Haitian people? How are we allowing the Haitian people to hold us accountable? One great example from the 2010 earthquake was the issue of soldiers. The U.S. spent in the first couple of months, a third of all expenditures were on U.S. soldiers to protect the aid shipments. And most of this was not necessary. And the soldiers were sitting there in their heavy uniforms with their big weapons and their Kevlar and everything else in the hot sun, and they really weren't needed. They admitted that, and there were lots of organizations across Haiti who said, we can distribute food without soldiers, just get us the food. And they weren't giving those organizations the food. Instead, they were doing these highly centralized rations that they felt they needed a battalion of soldiers just to distribute food to hungry people. We need to drop that kind of top-down, highly hierarchical distribution. We just need to get it to the people who know how to do it. There are U.S. organizations, there are Haitian organizations who knew how to do this. We need to let them do it. We need to do it in a way that the Haitian people can decide how best to help themselves.
Brian, I want you to dispel for us a carefully cultivated notion that the Haitian people, that the Haitian nation is one of total, at best, anarchy, and at worst, extreme chaos, that it is dysfunctional in any event, and therefore needs the intervention of the U.S. And of course, all of this is taken out of context of the fact that we have the first successful slave revolt in the world history and the first black republic set up in the hemisphere upon the notions of egalitarianism. So what are we to do to respect the self-determination of the Haitian people and dispel this terrible notion, which is utterly chauvinistic at best, incapable of self-governance?
Glad you described it as a carefully cultivated impression that Haitians can't run their own country. That was, of course, carefully cultivated starting in 1804 when Haiti had a slave revolt that led to an independent country. It's the only country founded of a slave revolt. And ever since 1804, the powerful countries, which in 1804 were slave-owning countries, they just could not allow Haiti to succeed. So they very carefully kept Haiti down through a range of military interventions, political interventions, economic war against Haiti, and, of course, just racist coverage in the press and in discussions by political and media. That has led to this idea that Haitians can't run things. And one of the problems is that the threat, obviously, in 1804 was that you would show that Haiti could demonstrate that people of African descent could run their country, which is deeply subversive of the U.S. economy, which was founded on slavery. Now you have a situation, but we don't like the idea of people running things. We have a fairly hierarchical economic, social, and political system. And Haitians, by insisting on a much less hierarchical system, insisting on having participatory democracy, that's a threat. So Haitians over and over again get going out in the streets and saying, we want real democracy. And the U.S. knows what that means. That means questioning corporate control of the economy. It means questioning the world in which countries like the United States get to dictate to everybody else in the world. And that's the wrong answer as far as the U.S. And because their way of responding to Haitians giving the wrong answer is to refuse to listen to them and instead putting in place people who will tell the U.S. what they want to hear. And those types of people, anybody willing to tell the U.S. what the U.S. wants to hear is by definition betraying the Haitian people. And so you have this escalating cycle where the U.S. will only accept people who are not representative of the Haitian people. And that obviously is incompatible with democracy as we're seeing now. And you not only have a situation of the current governing party that's run Haiti for 10 years, being corrupt and brutal, it's also just not effective at providing basic government services. And one clear example is the COVID vaccine. Haiti was the last country in the hemisphere to start vaccinating people. It is by far the lowest rate because nobody trusts the government. And you're going to have similar dynamics with the earthquake response, where the government isn't going to have the basic capacity to respond. And in addition, people aren't going to trust that the government has their interests at heart.
It's obvious we can't control the catastrophic effects of earthquake, but what we can do, that is the question. What additionally makes Haiti vulnerable to these natural phenomena, which indeed aren't natural, and then tell us what it is most immediately we must advocate for, whether it is particular agencies that we should be supporting for aid to Haiti and or positions that we should advocate to be true friends of our siblings in Haiti.
Another good example of what Haiti needs comes from Hurricane Matthew. It hit in 2016 and hit the same area that was hit by earthquake. When Hurricane Matthew hit Haiti and Cuba with about the same force, both in terms of wind and rain, in Cuba it killed, I think, two people, and in Haiti it killed around 1,000. Cuba is also is a relatively poor country, but they have been able to put in basic government services to evacuate people, to anticipate storms and to make things safe for people. And that's really what Haiti needs. It needs a government whose incentives are to provide basic services for the Haitian people rather than to listen to the dictates of the United States. In terms of what's happening in the United States to help that happen, one promising development that we've seen is that the Democrats, in especially the House of Representatives, led by Gregory Meeks, who's the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, have been really willing to push back against the Biden administration policy and calling for a more accountable U.S. policy towards Haiti. That involves just basically, when we are deciding what to do in the earthquake response, have Haitians involved in that. But it also involves much more fundamental issues like letting Haitians choose their own governments, stopping support for Haitian governments that are giving, that are telling the U.S. what they want to hear rather than doing what the Haitian voters want them to do.
Are there any agencies now or groups that are operational here, including your own, that we should lend our support to and can direct us to immediate assistance for the Haitian people?
Yes, there are. And the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, we're not doing direct assistance right now, but what we'll do soon in the next phase, which we expect will happen in a week or so, that people are going to be put in displacement camps and done in a way that does not respect their basic human rights, and then you'll have evictions and things like that. And we have lawyers on the ground that are starting to respond to that, and that need will only grow over the next few months. People can certainly support IJDH. Just go to www.ijdh.org, ijdh.org. You can make a donation online. But there's a list of organizations. I'm working with a coalition called the Haiti Response Coalition that involves U.S. groups and Haitian groups that have a progressive approach to Haiti. And we're putting together a list of people providing both direct support to victims, food, housing, medical care, things like that, as well as people advocating for a broader policy change that will improve resilience in Haiti. The best place that I know to find that, one place is on my Twitter feed. My Twitter feed is Haiti Justice, and right at the top of that is that list. But you could also Google Haiti Response Coalition, and I think you could find that list. And I'll try to get you a link to me as well.
Brian Concannon, Executive Director of the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti, thanks for your work. Thanks for taking the time to join us at this extremely busy time for you. Now we speak with Omar Ocampo, researcher with the Institute for Policy Studies, who joins us to talk about another tale of two classes. While SCOTUS paves the way to evict tens of thousands of tenants declaring pandemic-related economic hardship, global billionaires are seeing a $5.5 trillion pandemic wealth surge. Thank you for joining us, Omar Ocampo.
The Institute for Policy Studies, along with our partners, the Patriotic Millionaires, Oxfam International, and the Fight Inequality Alliance, we recently conducted a study, and then we found that the billionaire class, like about 2,690 individuals, saw their collective wealth increase $5.5 trillion since mid-March of last year. And as you said, all of this is in the context of unemployment, scarcity, economic precarity, people about to lose their homes, people about to be evicted. So to, you know, help put resources in the hands of the unemployed and those who may be suffering, you know, economic hardship and the risk of losing their homes, and make vaccines globally available, we recommend a 99% wealth tax. And at this rate, it would raise about $5.4 trillion, and it could make vaccines available globally, and would give unemployed workers a $20,000 grant. So a global pandemic requires a global response, and even at this tax rate, all billionaires will still remain billionaires, and in fact, they would have earned, you know, tens of millions of dollars in the past year.
So What can you tell us about the issue of this surge in global billionaire wealth as millions of people have lost their lives and livelihood? Isn't that the real sickness and pandemic that we face as well? Where is the profitability coming from?
So a report released last year by Swiss bank UBS pointed out that many have been able to exploit novel technologies and deliver new products and services. So tech innovation has definitely partly driven this increase in wealth over the past year. But in general, billionaires simply betted on the recovery of global stocks. This was a smart bet on their part because governments across the globe introduced very generous stimulus packages that attempted to alleviate the initial economic impact of the pandemic and to shore up their profits. In the United States, for example, the Federal Reserve purchased corporate bonds and basically guaranteed investors a floor. This pushed the stock market up. Also, large companies took advantage of the Paycheck Protection Program, which these funds were supposed to be used by small businesses to pay their employers, but the big companies were able to take advantage of it and then enrich their shareholders. So yeah, so there was a big increase in asset prices, and this explains why billionaires got $5.5 trillion richer, even as millions of people were suffering economically.
Well, what about in addition the role of the pharmaceutical companies itself with regard to the vaccine and their exclusive monopoly, even though there was the logic to develop with public money?
Yeah, exactly. And the unfortunate thing is that they want to privatize the profits, even though that there was a big collective effort through public taxpayer money in order to help and accelerate the vaccine. And this is why we also think that it should be absolutely free and it should be made globally available.
Omar, I speak to somebody who's a housing advocate and is on the precipice of deep and profound concern, as I said, about the U.S. Supreme Court's holding that opens the door for tens of thousands, at least, of evictions to ensue. So the COVID-19 pandemic, certainly in my experience, has pushed untold millions of people into poverty. Could you talk about that as a juxtaposition of this enormous wealth? And then why? We shouldn't be happy about this because we're told the economies are, by and large, recovering. Well, does the economy per se recover because billionaires make their wealth grow exponentially? So there's a two-part to that. What is pushing folks in the pandemic, it should be obvious, but perhaps it isn't, into abject poverty as opposed to the wealth that is garnered by certainly the 1%?
People living in poverty are less likely to have access to decent health care when they're ill. They're more likely to work in jobs that can't be remote, that put them at greater risk of contracting the virus. And they are more likely to suffer from underlying health conditions that put them at greater risk. People living in poverty also work in sectors such as retail and tourism, and they have suffered big job losses. That takes a huge hit on the savings of the workforce. Meanwhile, wealthier people are more likely to be able to work from home, less likely to contract the virus, and can afford quality health care. This is why the people who are working class are more likely affected by the virus, and they're actually more vulnerable to housing displacement. And I think that actually generates a very interesting conversation about affordable housing and housing in general, and how housing should be a human right and not something that's done for profit, because we should be able to house every single person in the country. And there's actually more empty homes than there are people who are houseless. So that would be a big thing that we should advocate for, is rethinking housing and making sure that it's, we can even argue that make sure it's publicly owned or even publicly funded.
And is this all due to the pandemic in the last year, year and a half, or what was the role of the tax cuts under the Trump administration with regard to the corporate tax cuts and individual tax cuts for the wealthy?
Yeah, so the tax cuts follow the same logic that it has for the past 30, 40 years, which is that low taxes and tax breaks stimulate economic growth and job creation. That argument is outdated, and all the data has proven that it is false. The rich don't invest in productivity or in job creation. Instead, they gamble with the money, invest it in complex financial instruments, or they just end up lending it to the same government that should be taxing them. Today, IMF is in favor of a one-off solidarity tax on wealth and high incomes to help pay for the recovery, and that there should be no austerity going forward. We need radical reforms so we can redistribute, guarantee like a basic income, and this starts with levying a tax on wealth.
Am I being too cynical or perhaps too ultra-left to say, but this is as American as proverbial apple pie, that we don't really care, that the system is not made to care, that the system is capitalism, and it doesn't give a damn about whether or not the population of the world is curbed through the misery of pandemic? I mean, is this, forgive me, almost a genocidal kind of reality, or just business as usual? I mean, how are we to understand this politically, that we see the enormity of this wealth for 1% as the world's people die and suffer enormous, terrifying miseries as a result of and push further down the ladder to impoverishment, certainly exacerbated by the pandemic? I mean, what are we to understand and take from this as a people who feel some sense of humanity and consideration, or are people of conscience and goodwill?
This shows that we have an enormous opportunity in order to build the movement in the United States. I agree that, unfortunately, our system stacks the deck against us. But there are signs for improvement, for a brighter future. For example, a good majority of Americans agree that the economy is rigged in favor of the rich. This gives us an opportunity to organize, movement build, try to rebuild the labor movement, have more unions, more taxes on the wealthy. Obviously, this takes a lot of work, but it can be done. We're seeing some of the first steps towards building a more equitable society where the abundance is shared.
The $5.5 trillion that was garnered by this pandemic wealth tax on the rich, how would that be used, and how would it affect not only the United States but the rest of the world?
With a 99% wealth tax on the $5.5 trillion made, first thing that we are advocating for is to end vaccine inequality. We estimate that each vaccine costs about $7. In order to be able to administer these vaccines and make it available globally, this 99% wealth tax will be able to fund that, in addition to giving people who suffered throughout the pandemic a $20,000 grant to help them get on their feet. They can use that money any way that they would like. It would definitely help paying off any debts or any back rent that they owe. In our report, just on the wealth tax from the profits they have made during the pandemic, this is what those resources will be used for.
And just to be clear, the distribution of vaccines from this wealth tax would not just be to the United States, but the rest of the world, right?
Correct. Every single country in the world, correct.
Your study shows that the COVID-19 pandemic has pushed over 200 million people into poverty, and that's according to estimates by World Bank researchers. So just to take a different position on this from my earlier left jab at capitalism, but isn't it even enormously foolhardy of capitalism to not address this, because the consequences for the system, which isn't it incredibly, enormously short-sighted of capitalism in any event, to not advantage and deal with people falling into greater poverty and indeed absolute economic devastation in the U.S. and in the world community as well.
I agree 1,000%. And the billionaire class is actually aware of this issue. And this is why they're even having conferences talking about what can we do about economic inequality and how can we alleviate poverty and provide equal opportunity. But unfortunately, even though they have good intentions, they're actually missing the overall point, because the thing that they're most resistant to is taxation. You know, in liberal democracies, there are only two policy measures that governments can do to raise significant revenue and redistribute and alleviate poverty, and that's expropriation and taxation. And expropriation in the United States, for example, is very unlikely. So the biggest threat to billionaire wealth is taxation. So if they want more stability in the future, where there isn't going to be, like, let's say, like a revolution, if they're trying to push off a revolution, then they're going to have to be willing to have increased taxation on their wealth, and also to perhaps change some of the structures that maybe, you know, capitalism shouldn't privilege shareholders. Maybe it should privilege its stakeholders, people who are working for them every single day, who that's producing the wealth, and let workers at least, you know, keep a larger portion of the wealth that they produce. So I think for them, it would be more intelligent to follow that road and let governments regulate markets. Otherwise, we can have social unrest develop in the future.
So just to follow up on that, I know that part of your report talks about the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Talk about what he's urged governments to consider in response to this, and what else you know of any other governments that are actually responding to the enormity of the profit margin from the billionaire class. And, of course, in the midst of COVID, as the rest of the world suffers economic and other hardship.
Even to the UN chief, he pushes for a tax on the rich and all those who have profited during the pandemic. This seems to be like a consensus. A little bit earlier, I mentioned how the IMF, which is for at least the past 30, 40 years, has been like the hub for like neoliberal structural readjustment policy throughout the global south. They have even come out in favor of some one-off wealth tax that helps pay for the recovery. I think has really shifted the narrative on the global scale. It makes people realize that everyone needs to pull their weight throughout the pandemic, and this includes the rich. And this is why it's essential for everyone in society to pay their fair share instead of just capturing wealth and let it concentrate at the top, because that has a lot of negative consequences throughout society and our politics. So I'm pleased to see that people are starting to realize even these institutions that have been advocating for austerity, that they're advocating for a wealth tax and some form of this redistribution.
In Argentina, the government has done something relevant to this. So if you could just talk about what Argentina has done and whether any other governments have begun to put a wealth tax that deals with the increasing inequality and the enormity of the devastation caused to people around the world as a result of COVID, or certainly their conditions devastatingly worsened with the advent of the COVID virus.
The Argentine government put forth a progressive 3.5% tax on wealth. The purpose of it was to pay for the consequences that resulted from the pandemic. Last I checked, that they were able to raise about like $2.4 billion from that tax. Also, in the context of a pandemic, the country of Colombia, which has a right-wing president named Iván Duque, he also introduced a wealth tax of 1% on assets above $1.3 million. And the rate gets even more progressive the higher your assets. So the higher amount of your assets, the higher the tax rate. They said that the revenue raised from this wealth tax is going to be transferred to households that are in poverty or extreme poverty. So So even right-wing governments are acknowledging that this vast inequality, especially in the context of the pandemic, is not sustainable and it's not good. It's not good for anyone.
We've been looking at inequality in the U.S. and abroad through the prism of the COVID pandemic. But even before the pandemic, for decades, the inequality in the United States has been growing. And I'd hate to think of us at the end of this pandemic, whenever that is, going back to the way we were before. So is there something we can do now to get a hold on post-pandemic in terms of decreasing inequality in this country?
I agree that we shouldn't focus just on the context of pandemic, because before the pandemic, inequality was really bad and is most likely to continue afterwards. I would say that the biggest threat to billionaire wealth is taxation. So therefore, our first step should be to raise taxes and strengthen tax enforcement. There's few taxes that I would advance. So a wealth tax, obviously. A second one would be a millionaire surtax. This is a tax, like a 10% tax on annual incomes over $3 million. And whether this income comes from dividends paid out by assets or wages or both, this could potentially raise $660 billion in the United States over the next decade. Another tax I would advocate for would be a more progressive estate tax. And the United States used to have in the progressive estate tax back in the 70s, but it has rolled back since then. And a progressive estate tax is something that's only applied to millionaires and billionaires. 99% of households in the U.S. would be exempt from it. All this is also to say that it's important to prevent such wealth concentration to happen in the first place. We could advocate for profit sharing in the workplace, or more democracy at work, or worker ownership, increase the labor movement, increase the level of unionization. And all this is to say is not to have wages dictated by the market. So at those policies, taxation plus an increased labor movement and more democracy at work, I think all those two combined would be able to stem wealth concentration that happened in the first place.
The coming together of the group is very important that put all these ideas together. So I wonder if you can talk about who they are. I'm drawn back in my mind to, I guess, roughly 10 years ago when the enormous popularity and growth worldwide of Occupy Wall Street took off. There seemed to be buttons everywhere which were tax the rich, tax the 1%, looking systemically at the inequality of wealth distribution and the accumulation of profits. So who's come together to jumpstart these demands and concerns that you've raised together? Because I think that's important.
There's a lot of groups that are advocating for like a more economic justice initiatives. One would be the Democratic Socialists of America. They have advanced a pretty progressive agenda. The Movement for Black Lives is another one. They also add a racial justice and racial inequality as well. Then there's also other groups like the Sunrise Movement. They also provide like a climate lens. So all these are great, and they're all interconnected. And
the Patriotic Millionaires, who are they?
So the Patriotic Millionaires are people who are millionaires who believe that they need to be taxed more by the federal government, because they acknowledge that with their tax cuts, they're actually not going to reinvest in productivity, for example, that they'll probably just put it in some stocks or some shares or derivatives and basically just try to expand their capital without necessarily benefiting anyone else. So they recognize that they have, in order to decrease inequality, provide more equal opportunity, that they need to be taxed at a higher rate.
So this is all part of an analysis released by Oxfam, the Fight Inequality Alliance, the Institute for Policy Studies, and the Patriotic Millionaires, with others on board. And we really want to thank you so much for joining us. And Omar, is there any particular significant salient point that we might have left out that you want to punctuate this discussion with?
I just want to highlight that taxation is just one step movement building, establishing horizontal links between movements here and across the globe is crucial in order to fight for a more equitable and economically and environmentally sustainable world.
And I guess the issue is, I don't guess, we have to still continue to rail against the 1%, the 1%. Omar Ocampo, thanks for revealing your findings in the report released by Oxfam, the Fight Inequality Alliance, the Institute for Policy Studies, and the Patriotic Millionaires. Now, we're joined by Nora Keller, New York Times product manager and union organizer, to talk about, well, if the New York Times claims to print all the news that's fit to print, why they failed to publish an article about their own tech staff walking off their jobs over the newspaper publisher's illegal efforts to stymie their unionization campaign. Thank you for joining us, Nora. Times wouldn't possibly have forced its tech staff to walk off their jobs over the newspaper publisher's illegal efforts to stymie your unionization campaign. Oh, do say it isn't so.
I think the response to our unionization efforts being so negative from management came as a real shock to everyone, including the folks organizing the effort. In the very beginning of this, when we started out the process, we asked for voluntary recognition, which is where we just get a majority of the eligible unit to sign cards saying that they want a union. Then the company can choose to voluntarily recognize us. And that's really the easiest, least contentious way for a unit to be recognized. And the New York Times did this in 2019 for our colleagues in Wirecutter. Truly, I think everyone was expecting that that's how it would go. And so when it didn't, that was pretty shocking. And then pretty shortly afterwards, the company began its pretty intense anti-union campaign.
All the news that's fit to print, the liberal veneer of the New York Times. So let's back up. Tell us about the work you do and who is trying to organize. And, of course, the story of why you think the Times is being so obstructionist to organizing a union.
We are the New York Times Tech Guild, and so we are all of the full-time and regular part-time folks who work for the New York Times websites and mobile applications in the United States. If you go to newyorktimes.com or if you open the New York Times on your phone or mobile application, what you're seeing there is what the folks in our guild have created. Anytime you see a new feature on any of those things, that's something that we've done and we've made possible. So we're made up of engineers, analysts, designers, product managers, which is what I do, and assistants. It's really just a very cross-functional tech unit because the nature of creating things for web and mobile applications takes a lot of hats, a lot of different input, but we all work in this very team-oriented way to make these things happen.
And what are your complaints?
And then in terms of issues that we're facing, this effort started very organically. It started with small conversations between colleagues in tech, voicing concerns from office things like a lack of gender-neutral restrooms or lackluster diversity initiatives or pay equity concerns. And that's ballooned into a push to create a more worker power-centered workplace so that we could push for the types of changes we wanted to see. And that ultimately translated into the effort of forming a union. Since then, union members and organizers have had many conversations with our colleagues all across the tech org. We've made an effort to speak to everyone eligible for the unit in one-on-one conversations to ask them, what do you want to see changed in your workplace? From that, we've heard overlapping ideas in terms of how they want that improved. You know, we've heard people say they care about pay equity, healthcare, job security, career development, diversity initiatives. That became solidified into what is the New York Times Tech Guild.
Would you say there's discrimination on the basis of race and gender?
I would. I think that it's not overt. The New York Times is a very old legacy workplace. Places that people look to hire from tend to be places that they're comfortable with and familiar with. You know, they look at pedigree and they look at, you know, where you went to school. tech has that same problem. Like, it's like there isn't a lot of equity in terms of like who has access to learn the, you know, very specialized skill set comes with these types of jobs. We think have like kind of regularly complained about things, and you know, I would say in a range of things. So like one is, you know, in the coverage, like a few years ago, a lot of folks were upset about a homophobic cartoon that the New York Times ran, or a year ago running a really salacious Tom Cotton op-ed. That's just the coverage part of it. And then like the inner more, which I think the part that affects us more is who are our leaders? You know, we have lackluster representation in company leadership, especially of Black and Latino folks, a thing that we want to see improve. The company folks at NYT, including in tech, have been vocal about this for a long time. And just within the past couple of years or so, management has started to respond to it and like begin some diversity initiatives, which is great. But the problem on our end is that we as workers have no way to hold management accountable to the things that they're saying. The gist of it is we really want the Times to become more diverse. The way that this happens is that we have to, as workers, be able to hold management to account on this. We have to be able to make sure that they commit to actionable items on this. This is something that we've seen our colleagues in the Newsroom Guild fight for in their contract, and this is similarly something that we want to fight for in ours.
Is it a matter of sheer politics? Employers don't like unions, liberal employers, whatever. You really don't want unions, and they don't want more folks in a bargaining unit when they can get less. Is it about that? Is it a matter of profit margins? Oh, pity the downtrodden press these days, whose back is all burdened with debt and decreasing advertising and readership, et cetera. I mean, how do you understand the objections and the truly bad behavior to try to stymie people in the tech unit from unionizing?
I don't think that I'm able to speak to the specifics around why the company is fighting us so much on this, partially because they're sort of refusing to sit down with us and talk about it. I do think that at some point, there's the New York Times, the brand, which is the paper that you read and the writers that create the work. And then there's the New York Times Corporation, right? It's a company, and the company is run by C-suite executives who care about shareholders. They care about ultimately power, right? If you are someone who sees power as a finite resource, right, and right now the status quo has it so that you can make decisions without having to check with your workers on how they feel. If you decide to lay off a group of people, you can lay them off. If you decide to make a change in the company, or if you change working conditions for the people who work there, if there's no union, you know, it's all up to you. That's probably, if you are a CEO, an easier time for you personally to be running a company, right? But ultimately, like, that's the issue, right? And that's something that I think we as workers and workers across the tech industry and workers across the United States increasingly are saying that we are not okay with.
Well, the New York Times playbook seems like something right out of a union buster's handbook, including favoritism, intimidation, captive audience meetings, and you had to file unfair labor practices complaints with the NLRB. Talk about their response, how they're trying to prevent you from having a union.
That playbook is consistent across these anti-union campaigns that different companies run, because ultimately, like, most of these people hire the same groups of lawyers, and those lawyers advise on the tactics that they think work. If you look as far as other anti-tech union busting campaigns, or even you can look at a company like Amazon, there are these like sort of regular tactics that the companies use, like captive audience meetings. We have filed 3 unfair labor practice charges against the company. First, one of our colleagues was told to stop showing public support for the union because they were saying that he was a manager because he was overseeing some interns briefly, which does not make him a manager. They were polling for support. We had like managers asking people, you know, how do you feel about the union, that kind of thing, which is something that companies are not supposed to be allowed to do. And then at some point, supervisor was indicating to employees that they would see increased benefits. They would probably see better and more improved terms and conditions for their employment if they did not continue to support the union. So all of these like tactics are totally outside of the realm of fairness. Further than that, like, sort of immediately we started seeing these captive audience meetings, just like general sense of intimidation and messaging from management saying that they are neutral, but like very regularly browbeating.
Yeah, why don't you just say what a captive audience meeting is? There are so many people who are not in unions or seeking to organize or who haven't ever experienced that.
So a captive audience meeting, this refers to these compulsory meetings that employees have to go to. You don't have a choice on whether or not you can go. And in that meeting, the employer will spew anti-union talking points at you. So taking time out of your day as a worker, and then they are forcing you to listen to their POV on things. The company has said that they haven't been doing this, which is just crazy to say to people who have sat through them. So I guess, I don't know, that's how it's falling.
They've also tried to influence the composition of the bargaining unit, who's in and who's out.
This is the latest thing that they've done. Like, this is the latest anti-union response they've had. I mean, through line of this is that they have fought us every single step of the way on this thing. They have moved goalposts on us constantly. So all while simultaneously refusing to directly engage us. So first they denied us the voluntary recognition through the card count. Then they went on to commit all of these unfair labor practices. And then we asked for an expedited, just a quicker version and an online version of the vote. And this was supported by a supermajority of the unit. And they said, no, you have to go through the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board. It's going to take us a lot longer. And the latest thing that they have done, their response to our filing to have this election, is that they want to exclude hundreds of our colleagues from the union, including myself as a product manager, which they want to exclude everyone who is not an engineer, which is a full third of our unit. The basis they've given for it is just absolutely nonsensical and is like a complete mischaracterization of how we work. They are saying that we don't have a community of interest. And then some folks they're saying are supervisors, including I'm a product manager, and they're saying that product managers are supervisors, which is news to me. I have never been able to hire or fire anyone, and I am certainly not paid the way supervisors are paid at the New York Times. It's like really every step of the way it's been a fight, and this is just like the latest injustice.
It sounds like it's a younger workforce and that your legacy organization is not quite up on the fact that perhaps young people have come to the point of recognition and understanding of the imperative of being able to bargain for wages and benefits, the rights on the job, a voice in the workplace, and a grievance procedure. I'm curious if those are the things that influenced you and your coworkers politically, ideologically, to agree to form a union. Is it a younger workforce? And if so, what attracted folks to union?
That's an interesting point. Speaking about our unit, we have like a range of ages, people who are involved in the unit and like around organizing. A lot of the organizers, however, are younger. I think that has a little more to do, if anything, not so much with interest, but like having the time to do it. It's a little harder to do if you have more responsibilities, right? That said, I do sort of see an interesting shift. I don't know if it's really like political so much as a different school of thought, right? Like, I think unions were really big amongst workers in what, like the 40s and the 50s and the 60s. And then in the 80s, there was this concerted effort by political figures to roll back the protections of unions and like the strength of unions in this country. And I don't know if it's so much that it's like young people are looking at things differently so much as tides are shifting generally. Like, I think it's just time, right? Like, since the 80s, we've had this kind of like pendulum swinging against unions. And now like we're starting to move a little bit back and like unions are becoming more popular. People are kind of realizing that this is like a pretty good avenue to get the type of working conditions that you want. You know, we as workers have had our power is rolled back just like very, very consistently. And I think that this is just like timing wise because of the pandemic, because of various political conditions and working conditions. Like this is like, I think a lot of people all across the country are saying like, okay, this is enough. I need to change something. People feel very frustrated with their power as individuals to have like such a little impact on these larger issues that are affecting their lives. So people are turning to collective power to get what they want. Hopefully this is the way to do it. I really believe it is. I think that as corporations have their lobbies, right? Like, and they have their lawyers and they have all of this money and they have all of this power. And the thing that the little guys have is numbers, right? And so we have to really play into that strength. I don't know if it's so much an age thing. I think now is the time.
Speaking of now is the time, you recently had a walkout. Can you tell us what specifically motivated that and how it went?
The walkout was a really incredible effort. We did walk off of the job, sort of walk off the job. We're all working remotely right now, so we basically closed our laptop. You know, what led up to that is we performed a lot of smaller actions, a petition. A lot of friends and family and people around the country signed asking the company to stop its unfair labor practices. We had a petition to the company that was signed by 70% of our eligible unit to ask for a after election. We have submitted questions to, you know, the company All Hands, which are unfortunately one way. We aren't allowed to engage, but we can submit questions to a forum. So we've done that. We have done all of these smaller actions, and like very consistently the response from the company has been either to ignore or totally brush off anything we've done. And so at this point, the thing that the company did, they had this plan to try to cut the unit down only engineers. We all just found that so unacceptable and such a slap in the face. We have a majority from every different job function saying that they want a union. And to say, well, we're only going to offer this to engineers, it was just really infuriating. And we felt like, okay, all of this other stuff hasn't worked. We're going to take a larger action. And this actually came together in just 24 hours, and we had over 300 people participate, which is more than half of the eligible unit.
Wow. So the enthusiasm, the energy is there. Sounds like there isn't any serious bargaining by the New York Times, but there certainly are a number of unfair labor practices. Tell us what the specific demands are of the tech staff.
What we want right now is for management to stop the delays and let us vote. So we want our whole unit, composed of all full-time and regular part-time engineers, analysts, designers, project managers, product managers, and assistants who perform work at the New York Times websites and mobile applications in the United States. That is our unit, and we want to be allowed to vote in an NLRB election. And we do not want this to be delayed any further. So once we are recognized, we will be able to go to the bargaining table with management. Before we begin bargaining, you know, we are going to work with everyone who is in the unit to decide on like what we want to go in our contract. So before that happens, like it's kind of hard to say what we're going to ultimately put in the contract, but there are five through our organizing that we have seen consistently come up, and which I think will definitely be in there because this is something that seemingly everyone in the unit seems to care about. The first is pay equity. There seems to be a really significant divergence in pay within titles, and we'd like to bring up salaries on the low end to a fair amount. Diversity and inclusion and equity. So we want to improve working conditions for the historically underrepresented colleagues, and we want leadership to take this seriously and agree to milestones on this. Career development at the New York Times has been very like ambiguous, especially in the tech unit, around responsibilities required at specific levels, promotion cadence, especially in non-engineering roles. And we want the union to provide workers with the framework to work on this and give them a seat at the table in figuring out a fair and equitable promotion process. Job security is a big one. All of our coworkers in this unit, like all non-unionized workers, are at will, which means that they can be fired at any point for any reason, whereas the union would provide just cause protections and shop stewards to ensure fairness through those processes. Finally, our healthcare prices are really on the high end. We've heard very concerning stories of the claims of being denied, and this is something that we want to be able to work to improve.
It seems like there's a lot of activity around the country by tech workers and other newspaper workers, media guilds, to organize at this point, including Google. Could you comment on the fact that you're not alone, that there's organizing of this nature throughout the country?
Tech is sort of an interesting space to be organizing in because it is a new industry. Because it's new and it was new in a time when unions weren't particularly popular, the idea of tech unions is a new idea. I think just in the short period of time that I've been involved in organizing my own tech unit, I have seen very consistent news stories of a lot of other units popping up and workers demanding to organize and bargain with management, which is so wonderful. Having a big name effort behind organizing in the tech space can really help. The big news story a couple of months ago was the Amazon union drive, which workers in Alabama, who unfortunately lost their election. But I think that being in the news constantly has also inspired a lot of workers. It's not just tech, right? I think that workers just across the country are recognizing that this is a really viable way for them to improve their working conditions and the lives of their coworkers and their families.
And lastly, if you could just comment on the strategicness of the tech workers to the publishing industry, to the New York Times. They're not merely some subsidiary volunteer, part-time kind of effort. You tell us what they are. How important is this staff and what is clearly a growing sector of the publishing industry?
Media and news is very different now than it was 10 or 20 years ago. All news media is very much digital first, and we are the people who are making it happen. The New York Times, I know that you had mentioned earlier the dire state of the newspaper industry. The New York Times has not fallen. It's not the failing New York Times. It's very successful, and a lot of that has to do not just with the journalism, but with the digital side of things. We kept the organization on the cutting edge of technology, of information distribution, and that's where most of our readership is at this point. It is online. The tech unit, if all of us stopped working tomorrow and refused to return to work, which, I'm not necessarily advocating for, but could happen, the company would cease to be able to function. And, I think you can listen to the pleas of our sister unit of guild workers for the New York Times, of all the writers and editors and folks who create the content. They know how important we are to the Times, and they believe that we should also have the same benefits that they do.
What do we do to show our support?
The best thing you can do to show support is write to the New York Times, tell them how you feel, give them what for about this. I would not say cancel your subscription. We're not calling for any sort of boycotts or anything like that. It wouldn't necessarily help. We will put the word out if that's what we go for. It is really helpful to get public pressure on this campaign. The New York Times cares deeply about its brand. They're very upset that we're talking to the press. They're very upset that we've, had a press conference and that we are making public their blunders. But, that ultimately that will really matter to them, I think.
Is there a number to call or text or email that you might have for those particular names that we should target?
So you can go to help.nytimes.com and you can contact, you can send a letter to the editor, you can contact a customer service person. There's a chat function on there. Or if you want to call on the phone, the customer service number is 1-800-698-4637. So 1-800-698-4637. Let them know how you feel.
Well, you're wonderful. I'm ready to cancel whenever you tell me to. But I do hope you get to that point. Nora Keller, New York Times product manager and union organizer. When the New York Times pushes back against unionization, we, its readers and subscribers, we're there to push back with you. This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Educate, agitate, and organize for the empowerment of we the people, for another world is possible.
Dear WBAI listener, we can certainly use a little help from our friends. After years of falling behind under new management, Pacifica has now gotten its financial papers in order and can apply once again for grants. That means WBAI, which is owned by the nonprofit Pacifica Foundation, can also apply for funding. And we are looking for a pro bono grant writer to help our 61-year-old station by writing grants for us. If you have time, expertise, and interest, please contact Bertol, our station manager, at bertol@wbai.org. You'd be helping to ensure the stability and growth of this historic listener-sponsored radio station. With details, please email bertol@wbai.org. That's B-E-R-T-H-O-L-D, bertol@wbai.org, with grant writer in the subject heading. Many thanks. Many, many thanks. This is Listener Spot.